He was right about one thing, though. He'd made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I didn't. I agreed to come up with a topic, research it thoroughly, and be ready to present it to the WICH-TV audience within the next couple of weeks. What was I thinking? Chapter 6. Although a hodgepodge of thoughts had been whirling around in my head all day, by the time I drove home to Winter Street that sunny Sunday, my poor brain was in a blender. What had I just signed up for? Of course I hadn't actually signed anything. The deal had been agreed upon with a handshake. But could I really do the job? As Mr. Doan had pointed out, I taught investigative reporting to others, but had no actual on-camera experience doing it. You can do this, I told myself. Like a mantra, I repeated the words aloud all the way home. You can do this. I hoped Aunt Ibby was back from church. I was sure she'd speak those encouraging words. It would be good to hear them from another human, even one who loves me and thinks I can do anything. I pulled the Stingray into the garage, delighted to see that the Buick was already there, and hurried to the house. I heard Elvis singing How Great Thou Art, appropriate Sunday music, as I knocked on the door, first gently, then a little louder to be heard above Elvis. Aunt Ibby opened the door, then turned down the sound just a tad. Come in, Merrily. My, don't you look pretty. You missed a lovely sermon about faith. Did you go out to lunch? Maybe I should have gone to church instead. I did, I said, though I didn't eat anything. I had a meeting with Bruce Doan. Sit down and tell me all about it, dear. I was just having a nice cup of tea. Want some? Yes, thanks. I accepted the tea, served in one of Grandmother Forbes's bone china cups. He made me an interesting offer, one he said I couldn't refuse. What is it? Don't keep me in suspense. I've been wondering what he wanted to talk to you about ever since yesterday. Okay, here it is. I leaned forward, facing her across the table. She leaned toward me at exactly the same time. We both laughed, and I relaxed a little bit. He's offered me a summer's internship as an investigative reporter for the station. She leaned back in her chair and clapped her hands. How wonderful! How very exciting for you! She raised one eyebrow and looked at me intently. You did accept, didn't you? When do you start? I did, I admitted. I promised to have my first report within the month, but I'm having second thoughts about it now. Second thoughts? Why? It's a great opportunity. I suppose there's no salary involved. That doesn't bother you, does it? No, of course not. Remember, I volunteered last summer for Mr. Pennington's theater project. No pay then, either. That's not it. Fortunately, money isn't a problem for me. Between a substantial inheritance from my parents, well managed by Aunt Ibby's financial advisors, and the insurance money from Johnny's accident, there were no worries in that department. I could easily afford to volunteer a couple of months of my time. Then what's holding you back? Seems to me it's made to order for you. I've never really done it before. Teaching's one thing, doing's another. That's what internships are for, silly girl. She smiled and squeezed my hand. You can do this. She'd spoken the magic words. I repeated them. I can do this. Of course you can. Faith, my darling child. Faith. Have you told Pete yet? She refilled my teacup. No, I haven't talked to anyone but you. He'll be happy for you. It might give you a bit of an edge, you know, having a gentleman friend on the police department. Aunt Ibby, you know we don't ever discuss his work. Again, that raised eyebrow. Do too. Well, hardly ever, I said, thinking about how just that morning I tried to figure out how to get Pete to tell me about the two dead witches without telling him what I already knew about them. Maybe once in a while. A little bit. Elvis began crooning, I believe, and feeling much better about the proposed job, and the world in general, I finished my tea, kissed my aunt, and went up the back stairs to my apartment. Orion was already in the living room, lying on his back, feet up on the zebra print wing chair. "Well, you look relaxed, Cat," I said. "All tired out from playing with your friends?" He rolled over, assuming a more gentlemanly position, yawned a long pink-tongued yawn, and went back to sleep. No conversational possibilities there. I looked at my watch. River would be up and about by now. I called her, and she answered on the first ring. "Hi, Lee," she said. "I was just about to call you. You heard about what happened to Chris Rich?" "I did," I said. "I know he's a friend of yours. He was lucky."
"I know. I talked to him this morning," she said. "Of course, he says it has nothing to do with luck. Says he has a permanent spell of protection around himself at all times."
"What do you think?"
"Who knows? Maybe he does. Some witches have more power than others."
She sounded pensive. "At least you don't have to go to another funeral," I said. "That part is lucky. Did you talk to Chris about the two who weren't out of the broom closet yet?"
"I did. Their secret isn't a secret anymore, though. That Chris is such a publicity hound, he's blabbed all about it to some reporter. Gave an exclusive interview all about how somebody is killing witches in Salem."
"No kidding. What reporter?"
"Don't know. I was mad at Chris for telling. I mean, if they wanted it known, they would have gone public. Maybe they'd even kept it secret from their own families. Anyway, I gave him hell about it. He hung up on me. I don't even know what station will air it."
"I'll bet anything it was Scott Palmer. He said he'd spoken with Rich. I'd turned off the news too soon." "I'm sorry, River. You two used to be friends."
"Oh, well, we'll get over it. People do. Anyway, he's involved with the plans for Megan's funeral on Wednesday, so we'll be fine."
Had River had bad thoughts about Christopher Rich? I didn't ask. "I heard that it's going to be at the old town hall." Her reply was soft.
"All of Salem loved her, so that seemed like the right place for the public service. It's such a beautiful old building. Of course, we'll hold our own ceremony, the real one, later. We Wiccans prefer to be buried without coffins, you know, to be returned to the earth. But that's against the law, so she's already been cremated."
"But you called me," she said. "What's going on?" "You'll never guess who I just had lunch with."
"I won't even try. Who?"
"Your boss, Bruce Doane."
"Oh, my God!"
Real gasp. "He's not going to fire me and hire you back, is he?"
"Of course not. He's not crazy.
But he did offer me a job. Sort of." I told River about the internship I'd just about accepted. "All right, I definitely accepted. With a handshake."
"Awesome," she said. "For you, that'll be a piece of cake."
"You and my aunt have more confidence about this than I do. But I'll admit it, I'm starting to get kind of excited about it. It's something I've always wanted to try."
"Piece of cake," she said again.
"No more cake, please. I feel as though I've been binging on the stuff lately."
"Oh, yeah. Shannon's wedding. How are plans coming along? It's pretty soon, isn't it?"
"Too soon," I sighed. "There's so much to do and not much time to do it. The invitations aren't even picked out yet."
"Don't worry. There are design programs that make beautiful ones in a day or two. They even make them at Walmart."
"Have they decided on a venue yet?" "Just that they want it outdoors somewhere. Any bright ideas?" A soft laugh on River's end of the phone.
"Since they met in a cemetery, maybe they'll decide to get married in one."
The mental picture of such a thing was so outrageous I had to laugh too. "You're a nut," I told her. "Seriously, if you think of any good wedding venues, let me know."
Another snicker. "Gallows Hill is pretty this time of year."
"Bye, River." I shook my head, hung up, and went to my room to pick out something to wear on my fried clams and a movie date with Pete. Orion eased down from his chair and trotted along behind me. I opened my closet and pulled out a couple of possible outfits and laid them on the bed. Orion, good boy that he is, jumped onto the bed, moving gracefully among pants, shirts, and sweaters, without feet, tail, or whiskers touching even one garment. The cat moved to the edge of the bed then, stretching out one paw toward the cherry wood frame, craning his neck as though he wanted to look into the glass. "Want to see yourself? Vanity, thy name is Cat." I tilted the oval frame in his direction, then selected a blue and white checked cotton shirt and a pair of navy-cropped pants from the items on the bed. Holding the shirt to my chest with one hand, pants to my waist in the other, I stood where I could see my own reflection. I was about to try the navy pants with a short-sleeved yellow blouse and navy sweater when my mirror image faded. The flashing lights and swirling colors that often precede a vision spread across the glass. As usual, I didn't want to watch whatever was going to appear. And, as usual, I couldn't look away. Once again I saw the pretty gazebo, close up this time and in more detail. It was in full sunlight, and although the white paint looked fresh, I could tell that the structure itself was not new. The gingerbread and intricate curlicues on the sides showed the subtle cracks of age and the worn surfaces of long usage. The person I'd seen there before was still seated, facing away from me toward the calm, sparkling sea in the distance. I could tell this time that the seated figure was a man. He wore a black jacket, black trousers, formal-looking. A tuxedo, maybe? A yellow paw snaked out, tapping the mirror, and as I watched, the scene revolved slowly until my vantage point was from the opposite side of the structure. Yes, I was right. The man, sitting upright and facing me, definitely wore a tuxedo. Orion tapped the mirror again, and like the zoom lens on a camera, the man appeared in close focus. I recognized him immediately. Christopher Rich. He sat there, unmoving, eyes wide, facing the sea. Once again, the close-up of the man. Those wide eyes were blank, unseeing. I'd seen eyes like that before. Dead eyes. Chapter 7. As quickly as it had appeared, the macabre scene vanished. The mirror showed only a startled redhead, a yellow blouse hanging limply from one hand. Christopher Rich. Dead? No, he was alive. River said she'd spoken to him this morning. He'd barely escaped death, though, according to the TV. I put the blouse on the bed and sat down next to Orion, who'd apparently lost interest in mirror tapping, and facing the wall had closed his eyes. So what was the vision trying to tell me? The mysterious but beautiful gazebo that overlooked a nameless beach, or maybe a shadowy graveyard, was somehow associated with witches, or a witch, or more specifically a dead witch. Of course, it was one who wasn't actually dead at all. One of the many problems associated with being a scryer is the fact that the visions never have a distinguishable timeline. They can depict scenes from the past, the present, and occasionally the future. They also can appear on just about any reflective surface. For me, they started out by showing up on shiny black things. Now I'm apt to see them in mirrors, store windows, even silverware or kitchen appliances. I decided to wear the yellow blouse and navy sweater and try to forget about the vision. I knew from past experience that the thing would probably eventually make some kind of sense, but those dead eyes were pretty hard to forget. By the time Pete arrived, I'd managed to once again focus my thoughts on what was real, not some hazy mirror image of the non-existent. What was real to me just then, and beginning to be quite appealing, was the internship at WICH-TV. I could hardly wait to tell him about my visit with Bruce Doan. "Hey, you were right," I said the moment he opened the door.
"Good,"
he said, and gave me a brief but sincere kiss.
"About what?"
"Mr. Doan. He actually did offer me a job. Kind of."
"What kind of job?"
"Investigative reporter." I paused for dramatic effect, then smiled. "Kind of. It's an internship for the summer. What do you think about it?"
"Are you kidding? I think you should do it. When do you start?"
"I start a week from Thursday. Dubs for fried clams to celebrate?"
"Absolutely. And Manchester by the Sea is playing again at Cinema Salem."
"Perfect," I said. "We don't even have to do the ritual coin toss. That was my pick, too."
"Movie first?"
I agreed. We headed for the comfortable neighborhood theater where the popcorn is made with real butter, and watched Kyle Chandler and Casey Affleck as the story played out against background scenery Pete and I know well. The real Manchester by the Sea is just a few miles away from Salem, and we nudged one another and whispered as we recognized places we knew in Beverly, Lynn, and Gloucester. There was one distance shot that took my concentration away from the on-screen troubles. The actors were on a boat, passing the typical patchwork scenery of Cape Ann's coastline, mansions and shacks, yachts and lobster boats, columning wharves and massive pilings, the old Tar and Wanson paint factory, and Hammond Castle. The thing that captured my attention, though, was a small white gazebo. It wasn't the one in my vision, it was a much plainer version, but similar enough to bring back the beach and the dead Christopher Rich. After the movie, we drove over to Jefferson Avenue and Dube's Seafood Restaurant. It's been there forever. Aunt Ibby remembers going there with her parents. We ordered their justly famous fried clams.
"Hey, we're here to celebrate your new job. You okay?"
Pete asked.
"You're awfully quiet."
"I'm okay," I said. "It's just that, well, I know you don't like to talk about it, but..."
"You've been seeing things?"
That's what Pete calls the scryer thing I do, seeing things. "Yes, afraid so. Can I tell you about it?" He reached for my hand.
"Of course you can, Lee. You can always tell me about anything. And it isn't that I don't like to talk about it. It's the fact that you see these things, things that frighten you, and there's nothing I can do to protect you from them."
I hadn't ever thought about it that way. There was such sincerity, such love in his eyes that I felt tears welling up in mine. "Thank you, Pete," I whispered. "I always want to share these things with you, whatever they are, wherever they come from. But sometimes, no, usually, they don't make any sense." He smiled and squeezed my hand.
"Try me."
I took a deep breath. "Okay. There's been more than one in the past few days. I've tried to put them out of my mind, but a scene in the movie tonight brought them back." Our food arrived, and it gave me a moment to sort out my thoughts. Since Christopher Rich had, as Rivers said, blabbed to a reporter about Gloria Tasker and Mr. Bagginstos being witches after the attempt on his own life, I didn't have to protect their secret anymore. Pete and the rest of the police force undoubtedly knew now that someone wanted to kill witches in Salem. What does a pretty little white gazebo have to do with it?
Pete put ketchup on his fried clams and passed the bottle to me.
"Go on,"
he prompted.
"Tell me what you saw."
I told him in as much detail as I could remember about each of the two scenes the mirror had shown.
He frowned. "So, the figure you saw in the first one, the man sitting in the gazebo who had his back turned to you, turned out to be the shop owner, Rich, in the second one?"
"Right," I nodded. "He was dead. At least he definitely looked dead to me."
"He's very much alive. Whoever took a shot at him last night missed him by a mile. There are a couple of bullet holes in the wall of the building. Forensics is working on that."
"So maybe someone, even someone who's a bad shot, is targeting witches?"
"I didn't say that. I suppose your friend River must have tipped you off that Baginstows and Tasker were witches."
"She did," I admitted. "I wanted to tell you, but River said even their families might not have known about it."
"We knew about them."
I was surprised. "You did?"
"Sure. Some of their fellow witches tipped us off as soon as Ms. Tasker got run down."
"Of course. I suddenly got it. They were worried about their own safety."
"I didn't say that,"
he repeated.
"Why, is River worried?"
He cocked his head to one side the way he does when he's trying to figure something out.
"Did she say she was?"
Had River seemed worried about her own safety? I paused before answering. "Not exactly," I said. He raised a questioning eyebrow. "You're going to think this is strange," I began. "I know I think it is. River is worried, but not about her own safety."
"Go on."
"I don't want you to take this the wrong way." I dropped my voice, aware of others at nearby tables who might overhear. "But River is afraid the deaths, including Megan's, could be her fault."
"Her fault? How's that? What did she do?"
"Oh, Pete, she didn't do anything. She said she had some bad thoughts about Gloria and Mr. Baginstows and even about Megan. She's worried that she could have put some kind of spell on them."
"Thoughts don't kill people."
"That's exactly what I told her. She said that in the old days, in the old religion, bad thoughts could kill people." He was quiet for a long moment. The waitress cleared away our dishes, brought coffee and a doggy bag with a few fried clams for Orion. Pete spoke in his cop voice.
"Did River have bad thoughts about Christopher Rich, too?"
"She didn't say so. I'm sure they were friends, even though she was a little bit annoyed because he talked to the press about the others secretly being witches."
"Yeah, I thought that was a little over the top, too."
His normal voice was back.
"Especially since their friends and relatives didn't know about it."
"They didn't?"
"Far as we can tell, they didn't. The board of directors at the bank wasn't too pleased about learning that Baginstows was one of those, people."
"I'll bet. Did Gloria have any family?"
"Not around here."
He picked up the check.
"Ready?"
There was no more conversation about witches, living or dead, on the ride back to Winter Street. Instead, we talked about my summer job at the TV station.
"I think you'll enjoy it, Lee,"
he said.
"You still have friends at the station, so it won't be like starting at a brand new place."
He smiled.
"Even though the job description is a lot different than the last one you had there."
"You mean the call yourself Crystal Moon, dress up in ruffles and beads and hoop earrings every night, consult the obsidian ball, ask people for their birth dates, and totally fake the answers to whatever they ask? That job?"
"That's the one. You made an awfully cute fortune teller, though."
I didn't regret everything about my brief stint as the host of Nightshades. After all, that was how I met Pete. "I still have some of the costumes, you know." Wink, wink. We pulled up in front of the house on Winter Street.
"If I didn't have to go to work early, I'd ask for a fashion show,"
he said, pulling me close for a good night kiss.
"Wink, wink back at ya."
He waited, while I ran up the stairs to the front door. I turned and waved as I put my key in the lock. Orion, as always, was just inside, peeking from one of the narrow side windows. Pete gave a brief wave and a tiny toot of the horn and drove away as I opened the door and entered the foyer. "Hi, Orion," I said, holding the doggy bag over his head. "Brought you a goodie." The lights were off in Aunt Ibby's living room, and there was no sound of TV, radio, or Alexa issuing from the rest of the first floor, so I assumed that my aunt had already gone upstairs to her room on the second floor. I locked the front door, activating the alarm system, and climbed the stairs with a cat, pink nose and whiskers twitching, following me up to my apartment. While Orion nibbled, more or less daintily, on his cold fried clams, I changed into jammies and turned on the bedroom TV. The new guy, Buck Covington, was in the anchor chair, and I was interested in watching him work. As Mr. Doan had said, he looked good, and his voice was excellent. The facial expressions matched the words. Happy face for the kids' lemonade stand for charity report. Solemn demeanor for a four-alarm fire in Saugus. There was no further mention of the near shooting of Christopher Rich. If Covington was really dumb as a brick, it sure didn't show. His reading of the prompter was letter perfect, not a flubbed word or mispronounced syllable that I could spot. Orion joined me on the bed, washed his face and paws, then curled up on the pillow beside me. Since it was Sunday, River's show wasn't on, and I didn't want to watch WYCH-TV's video of highlights from last summer's Topps Field Fair. Flipping through the channels, I landed in the middle of one of my old favorites, the hilarious Hocus Pocus, where Bette Midler led the antics of three witches back in Salem after three centuries away. It reminded me of River's warning that the old-time witches could really do some evil stuff with their bad thoughts. If only the deaths of three 21st-century Salem witches and the near-miss shooting of another were funny. They weren't. I pulled my cat closer and turned off the TV. The deaths of Gloria Tasker and Elliot Bagginstose could easily have been dismissed as coincidental. Megan's passing was quite certainly age-related. But Christopher Rich's experience led to the almost unavoidable conclusion. Even if Pete didn't want to say so, someone out there was targeting Salem's witches. Chapter 8. It was Monday morning, the last day of the school year at the Tabitha Trumbull Academy for the Arts. I dressed carefully for the occasion in a gray striped business suit, white frilly blouse, and gray heels. It's not exactly a graduation, as the Tabby doesn't award degrees. The programs in the arts, including music, dance, painting, acting, writing, and, in my case, TV production, are open to everyone. All that's needed is a desire to learn, and the ability to pay the not-insignificant tuition. There's a commencement ceremony, though, where students, guests, and faculty gather in the Tabby's Theater for School Director Rupert Pennington's final address of the year, followed by a reception with tea and punch, dainty sandwiches, and cookies. I joined my fellow faculty members on stage. We were seated in a double row of chairs behind the podium, facing the audience. Mr. Pennington, his back to us, approached his lectern, raising his hands for silence. The hum of conversation stilled. I looked out over the sea of faces, trying to spot my TV production students. There'd been six of them this year, two men and four women. Dorothy Alden had already returned to her home in Alaska, but I expected that the rest of them must be part of the crowd. I spotted the Temple twins and Hilda Mendez sitting together near the front of the room. Therese would be filming the procedure, of course, and I was sure that Shannon Dumas would be there.
Shannon had told me that she and her handsome artist fiancé, Dakota Berman, were coming, and that they planned to bring a surprise member of the wedding party with them. I hadn't yet met Dakota's best man, and assumed that would be the surprise. I looked forward to meeting him, and wondered if he was another artist.
"Welcome, welcome," Mr. Pennington intoned. "We've come to the end of yet another successful school year here at the Tabitha Trumbull Academy for the Arts. Our dancers have earned acclaim, performing in venues around the country."
He paused for applause, and the instructors of the various disciplines of dance each rose, looking slightly embarrassed. Theater arts, oil painting, and watercolor instructors were introduced next, with ringing words about award-winning art exhibits and smash-hit play productions. The music department was lauded with mention of the Tabby Band taking part in the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Boston, and the school orchestra playing at the mayor's inauguration ceremony. The directors, instructors, and arrangers stood and bowed. The creative writing classes were next, with instructors in poetry, short stories, novels, and magazine articles praised and thanked. TV production was mentioned last, and because I was the one and only instructor, least.
"Ms. Barrett's TV production classes have not only brought much favorable publicity to the school," Mr. Pennington said, "but have resulted in 2 generous government grants. Several of her students have already gone on to productive careers within the industry."
I stood, acknowledged the applause, smiled modestly, and sat down as quickly as I could. During that brief moment of standing, I looked over the crowd. Therese, with her video camera, stood in the center aisle, focusing on Mr. Pennington. Aunt Ibby, beaming proudly, was in the first row along with the mayor and other dignitaries. Dating the head man has its advantages. I continued to scan the faces in the audience, looking for Shannon, who was not known for being punctual, then settled back in my chair, concentrating on the welcoming words from Mr. Pennington, who was not known for being brief. He was about 10 minutes into his speech when I became aware of some kind of commotion at the rear of the theater. The house lights were all on, so it was not difficult to see what was happening. Mr. Pennington shaded his eyes with one hand, peering toward the back door. Shannon Dumas had arrived. The disturbance, causing a growing buzz of conversation, wasn't due to the fact that Shannon is uncommonly pretty, nor because her fiancé, Dakota Berman, was undoubtedly the handsomest man in the room. It was because there was a very large black-and-white bird perched on her shoulder, and the bird, nodding left and right as the couple moved down the aisle, called out quite plainly and repeatedly,
"Who loves you, baby?"
"Sorry," Shannon called out. "He'll stop in a minute. Hush, Poe."
Holding the bird by a blue leash attached to its leg, she smiled, flashing dimples, and the couple slid into aisle seats close to the rear of the long room. The bird did indeed stop talking, although some members of the audience didn't, and the director resumed his address, picking up where he'd been interrupted, at the part about the many long years of retail success the Trumbull family had enjoyed in the old building. Could this large talking bird be the surprise member of the wedding party Shannon had announced? Concentrating on the speech was out of the question by then. The summer internship at the station might have to take a back seat to wedding planning for a while, I realized. The upcoming nuptials had already become more complicated than I'd anticipated. I'd been a bridesmaid before, but never maid of honor. Some honor! I'd probably have to arrange for a custom-made tuxedo for a bird, along with everything else. The mental picture nearly made me laugh aloud. A burst of applause indicated that Mr. Pennington's speech had come to a close, and I once again focused on the present. Bobby Millard, one of the painting instructors and a high school classmate of mine, leaned across the seat between us.
"Isn't that one of your people, the girl with the bird?"
"Uh-huh."
My reply was hesitant. "Shannon Dumas, good student."
I was about to add something along the lines of, I didn't even know she had a bird. It's a surprise to me. But Bobby, grinning, continued, It's an African pied crow. A beauty. I'd heard they could talk, but I never had the chance to hear one before. Can you introduce me to, what's her name, Shannon?
Sure, I said. A pied crow, you called it?
Right. It's spelled P-I-E-D, but you say pied. It means patchy, mottled, kind of like an early Jackson Pollock. See the random white feathers on it? He lowered his voice. I don't think Pennington was too happy about being interrupted, but he recovered pretty well, didn't he? We left the stage, and Bobby followed me down the aisle toward Shannon and Dakota, who were already surrounded by a small crowd. It takes a lot to rattle Mr. Pennington, I said. But I guess who loves you, baby, in the middle of a speech could do it.
Ruffle his feathers, so to speak.
Bobby laughed at his own bad pun, and we joined the chattering group around the young couple. Therese was there, too, focusing her camera on the black-and-white bird, which was now perched on the back of a chair, while still attached by a little strap on its leg to the bright blue leather leash tied to Shannon's wrist.
"Oh, hello, Lee," Shannon called. "Come and meet Poe. He's going to be ring-bearer at our wedding."
"Here comes the bride,"
the bird said, fixing a bright black eye on me.
"Who loves you, baby?"
On closer inspection, the thing looked enormous. It stood about a foot tall, and the beak looked like a formidable weapon. I backed away instinctively. "Does he bite?" I asked.
"He could if he wanted to, I guess," she said. "He's never bitten me, and I've known him all my life."
I introduced Bobby, who stood a good distance away from Poe, too. "You never mentioned that you had a pet bird," I said. Dakota spoke up.
"Oh, he's not ours. Belongs to Shannon's dad. She's staying at his place in Marblehead to take care of Poe till her father gets back from a business trip. He'll be here for the wedding, of course. So will Poe, so we thought we'd give him something to do. They're very social, these crows."
"You said you've known him all your life, Shannon?" I said, surprised. "How old is he?"
"He's over 20," she said. "My dad hand-raised him. He has his own aviary behind Daddy's house, with heat and air conditioning and even a TV."
"He especially likes those window glass cleaner TV commercials with the crows in them," Dakota said.
"Aren't you Dakota Berman?" Bobby asked the groom-to-be. "You do those fabulous cemetery paintings, don't you?" Dakota nodded modestly. "Guilty. I teach watercolors and pastels here at the Tabby." Bobby looked hopeful. "Maybe sometime next semester you'll come and talk to my class. Maybe do a little demonstration of your technique."
"Glad to."
The two men moved to one side and continued their conversation about art, while I focused on the plan of a crow being part of the wedding party.
"The idea about Poe being a ring-bearer is quite original, Shannon."
I tried to keep my tone level, without any hint of surprise, bewilderment, or annoyance, all of which were present at the moment. I returned the bird's baleful stare.
"Why didn't you tell us about this, unusual pet before this?"
She stroked the bird's head gently.
"Never thought about it. As I said, he belongs to my dad. Poe knows me pretty well, though, ever since I was a little girl. Don't you, Poe?"
The bird said, "Pretty girl," and lifted its wings slightly. Oh, my God. The thing must have a wingspan a yard wide.
"Are his wings clipped?" I asked, backing away a little farther. "I mean, can he fly?"
"Oh, sure, he can fly. But don't worry, I have him tethered."
She tapped the blue leash.
"You plan for Poe here to be the ring-bearer, then?"
"Right. My dad will be giving me away, of course, and Poe will be on his shoulder when we come down the aisle together. I'll hand my bouquet to the maid of honor. That's you, Lee."
Big smile.
"Poe will have the rings in a little mesh bag tied to one foot. I'll untie it and hand the rings to the minister. Then Daddy and Po go and sit down in the first row, and the ceremony goes on. Cool, huh?
Yes, cool, of course, and out of the ordinary, to say the least.
I know.
Shannon sighed a happy sigh.
Therese says it'll make a great video, maybe even go viral.
I had to agree. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. But look, Mr. Pennington seems to be making his way down the aisle in this direction. Perhaps you and Poe should head outside?
The director was not smiling.
Oops! Come on, Dakota!
She tugged at her fiancé's elbow.
Let's go! Maybe we'd better skip the reception, huh? See you tomorrow, Lee? Gown shopping?
Huh? Oh, sure. I'd forgotten all about the bridal shop appointment. Oh, well, I'd figure out how to fit it in. Everything will get done on time. It'll all turn out fine, I told myself. I watched Shannon, Dakota, and the bird hurrying toward the exit. The bird had turned his head around to what looked like an impossible angle, and it seemed to me those bright eyes were once again fixed on me.
"Who loves you, baby?"
he shrieked.
"Hey, Red! Who loves you?"
I dutifully attended the reception that was held on the top floors of the Trumbull Building, in the handsomely restored and reputedly haunted suite of rooms that had long ago housed the Trumbull family. The enormous dining room, with a glittering chandelier and 12-foot-long Empire mahogany banquet table, displayed assorted food offerings to great advantage. I smiled when I recognized Fabio, the baker from Pretty Party, filling huge silver platters with a variety of gorgeous pastries, performing the restocking duties with a magician's flourish. Students, staff, family members, and guests wandered through the luxurious apartment or sat in conversational groups nibbling on the catered delicacies. I chatted briefly with the Temple twins, two retired Boston police officers looking forward to second careers in TV, and talked to Trace's parents, who, as always, thanked me profusely for encouraging their daughter's interest in photography. They were, however, blissfully unaware of her interest in witchcraft. I nibbled on a miniature chocolate éclair, and balancing a pressed glass punch cup, I strolled from room to spacious room until I found myself alone in one that had long ago been Tabitha Trumbull's sitting room. I guess now we'd call it her home office. I pictured her at the small desk, filling out the recipe cards that Aunt Ibby had brought back to new life in her Tabitha Trumbull cookbook. I sat in Tabitha's chair and tried to concentrate on the present. My own personal present. It's hard to focus thoughts when a crow you've never seen before calls you by one of your nicknames. But turning that aside for the moment, I thought about the upcoming wedding. I did remember, once Shannon had jogged my memory, that we had a morning appointment at Blushing Bride in Peabody, one of the North Shore's most famous bridal salons. Finding a wedding dress appropriate for an outdoor event and coordinated outfits for me and the bridesmaids, Hilda Mendez and Shannon's cousin Maureen, shouldn't be too complicated. I took a sip of punch and moved on to thoughts about the job I'd just accepted at WICH-TV. I'd said I could dig up my own topics to investigate. I was beginning to hope for assignments instead. I realized that I hadn't the first clue on anything interesting, except the seeming spate of witch deaths in Salem, and I didn't feel ready, willing, or even remotely qualified to delve into that. Just in passing, was a talking crow who called me Red, my not very favorite nickname, a sufficient attention grabber? I didn't think so. My recent scrying experiences might be leading me towards something noteworthy. They usually do, but so far I couldn't figure out what they meant. What was the meaning of a Victorian gazebo and a dead witch? Christopher Rich, who wasn't really dead, but who'd apparently been shot at. All this reverie led nowhere.
so I didn't mind in the least being interrupted when Bobby Millard appeared in the doorway of the room.
"Oh, here you are. Mind if I join you for a minute, Lee?"
he said. Not waiting for an answer, he slid into a rose floral upholstered green wicker armchair and faced me, his expression serious.
"I just overheard something I think you might want to know about."
"Sure. What is it?"
"First of all, I think you've known me long enough to know I'm not a nosy person. I mean, I don't go around purposely eavesdropping on other people's conversations."
"Of course you don't, Bobby."
"It's just that I happen to be standing right behind them. I wasn't trying to listen to what they were talking about."
"Slow down," I said. "Standing behind who?"
"Oh, Dakota Berman and Shannon. Did I tell you Dakota might speak to my class next semester?"
"Yes, I was there when you asked him." "So you overheard something Dakota and Shannon were talking about?" I prompted.
"Right. It was about their best man."
"I haven't met him yet. I guess he's from out of town."
I frowned. "I don't even know his name."
"I do." Bobby shook his head and leaned back in the chair.
"I recognized that name as soon as I heard Dakota say it. Sean Madigan."
He looked at me expectantly, as though he thought I should recognize that name too. "Sean Madigan."
I didn't.
"Sorry," I said. "Should that mean something to me?"
"It was in all the papers 6 years ago,"
Bobby said.
"He went to jail."
"That was back when I was living in Florida," I said. "Must have missed it. Anyway, what does this Sean Madigan person have to do with Dakota? Why did he go to jail?"
Bobby moved forward in his chair again, looking at me intently, while a new thought flashed through my poor, tired brain. "I'm involved in a wedding where not only is a bird the ring-bearer, but, according to Bobby, a jailbird is the best man.
I went to some classes with Sean in Boston. Museum of Fine Arts."
Would he ever get to the point? I hoped he didn't ramble this way when he taught his art students at the Tabby.
"I know, famous school. Bobby, what did you hear?" "I didn't even realize he was out of jail, you know. Did 6 years. Sentenced to 10, but had good behavior, I guess. Anyway, Shannon was telling Dakota that she's worried about having Sean stay at her dad's house on account of his being, you know, kind of a thief."
"What kind of a thief? What did this guy steal?"
"Paintings. He stole small, very good paintings from small, very good museums. I don't remember how he did it exactly, but I'm going to look it up. Anyway, then he copied them and put them back. Got away with it for quite a while, too."
Bobby's tone had slipped from worried to respectful.
"Of course, eventually he got caught. Anyway, they haven't told Shannon's dad who the best man is going to be yet. But see, they have to. Sean's in Salem already, and now Shannon's invited him to stay at her dad's place. Big, big house. You ever see it?"
"No, I never have." "If this Sean has, as they say, paid his debt to society, won't Shannon's father be understanding about it?" I paused for a moment, thinking of this rather peculiar crime. "Why did he do it? Steal them, then put them back?"
"Sold the copies as the real thing to underground collectors. He's really very good at making copies. We all made copies at the museum. Copying the masters is part of the learning process. But later on, Sean took it to another level."
His tone reflected grudging admiration.
"The son of a gun figured out how to do the varnishes, the brushwork, the type of canvas, the cracking of the paint. Never used pigments or binding that was introduced after the artist's death. Amazing talent."
"You said underground collectors?"
"Yeah. There are people who don't care if a painting is stolen. They just want to own a real Cézanne or Degas or Van Gogh or whatever."
"They must have to keep it hidden, never show it to anybody."
"How strange."
"I know.
Anyway, Madigan would anonymously sell copies to two or three of these collectors for big bucks in cash, then send the original back to where he'd stolen it from.
Uh-oh, how'd he do that?
Rolled it up, put it in a tube mailer, and dropped it in a mailbox, always from another state. Then, after a while, probably when he ran out of money, he'd steal another one, paint copies, find a new group of collectors. They're all over the world, you know. And do it again.
That made a certain amount of sense.
I see.
And when the collectors learned that the real one had been returned, they couldn't report the fakes because knowingly buying stolen paintings is a crime.
He nodded.
Right. Anyway, Sean's the one who taught Dakota how to do those paintings that look like gravestone rubbings. You've seen them. Wonderful things.
Bobby gave a low whistle.
I hope when he visits my class next semester, he'll give a demonstration.
You think he might? You seem to know him pretty well.
He does them in plain sight at the cemetery, so I don't see why he wouldn't.
I didn't actually know Dakota all that well. We'd only met a few months ago.
But I had to admit to myself, it had been a pretty intense couple of months, involving one of Salem's most historic cemeteries, where not all of the bodies always rest in peace.
I stood, brushing a few crumbs from my skirt, and picked up my empty punch cup.
Well, guess I should get back to the reception.
Me too, Bobby said,
and followed me down one of the long corridors to the Trumbulls' formal parlor, with its blue moire taffeta wall coverings, antique furniture, and assorted oil paintings in gilded frames. I wonder if the paintings are originals or copies.
How can you tell?
I said so long to Bobby and looked around for Aunt Ibby. Deciding that she'd probably already left, I chatted for a few minutes with visitors, ate a tiny frosted cupcake, and took the elegantly appointed Trumbull family elevator down one floor. The old store elevators provided the rest of the trip to the street level. I liked those best. The directory on the pressed tin walls still bore the original postings, lingerie, foundations, hosiery, sportswear, millinery. The Buick wasn't in the parking lot, neither was Dakota Berman's pickup truck. I assumed that the engaged couple and their crow had wisely left the premises. I backed the vet out and headed down Washington Street to Church Street, to home.
There are lots of beautiful trees in our neighborhood. Maples, oaks, chestnuts. They're always pretty.
In the springtime, the chestnut trees are bright with green buds and even some white blossoms. Summer brings the full display of leaves and fruit, acorns and chestnuts, and in the fall the resplendent golds and reds and browns are magnificent. Even in winter, when snow and ice coat bare branches, they glisten like diamonds. But on this early summer day, after the commencement at the Tabby, when I turned onto Oliver Street, the trees had a different look. It seemed that they were full of birds. Dark birds, calling to one another. Blackbirds? Ravens? They were crows. Not the black and white mottled crows. The pied crows. These were plain old black crows. Nothing rare there, but I don't remember ever seeing them in numbers like this in our neighborhood. There must have been about 50 of them in and around the trees along the street, and their raucous caw, caw, caw was both loud and monotonous. Maybe, I told myself, maybe they'd just arrived from down south, like the robins do every spring. Do crows migrate? I'd have to ask Aunt Ibby. It's very handy, having a reference librarian for an aunt. My own live-in human Google. I tapped my garage door opener and pulled the vet inside, hoping that the noisy birds hadn't pooped on it, and parked next to the Buick. She beat me home. Maybe she skipped the reception. I didn't see her in the Trumbull suite. Hurrying through the backyard, past Aunt Ibby's vegetable and herb garden, I wondered how a scarecrow might look among the pole beans and pumpkins. After climbing the back steps, I unlocked the door. As usual, Orion was there to greet me with loud purrs and his cat smile, kind of a head cocked to one side, eyes wide, happy look on his fuzzy face. I bent and picked him up, disregarding the likelihood of cat hair on the needs-to-be-dry-cleaned suit. I pulled the door closed, realizing at that moment that the bird noise had suddenly stopped. I paused for a moment, debating whether to start up the stairs to my apartment or stop to check on my aunt. Orion made the decision for me, jumping down from my arms and disappearing through the cat door into Aunt Ibby's kitchen. I heard the clink of dishes and the ping of pans, so I knew she was in there cooking. Or cleaning. I knocked.
"Is that you, Merrily?" she called. "Wait a second while I dry my hands."
"It's me," I answered. "Take your time. Just want to say hi."
"Come in, come in."
She opened the door, wiping her hands on a red and white striped apron with "Kiss the Cook" embroidered on it.
"It was a lovely ceremony, wasn't it? I thought Rupert's speech was excellent, didn't you?"
"Excellent," I agreed, not remembering much of what he'd said. "But I missed seeing you at the reception. Were you there?"
"No, I skipped it."
She patted her waistline.
"Didn't need the calories, and besides, I had some research I wanted to do."
"Research? About what?"
"Crows," she said.
Chapter 9 "Crows? Like the ones in the trees out back?" I asked. "What's going on with them, anyway?"
"That's what the Massachusetts Audubon Society is trying to figure out. You know I'm a member."
My aunt spoke proudly. "Of course." Orion, checking out the contents of his red bowl, looked up at the mention of crows and gave a low growl. The sound surprised me. He's always shown a normal, cat-like interest in birds, but I've never known him to harm one. Sounds as though Orion doesn't like them in his yard.
"I know. It's uncommon for them to be here in Salem in such numbers at this time of year. That's what we're trying to figure out."
"Do they migrate here from some other place? I was wondering about that just a few minutes ago."
"Some do. We have a year-round population, and then there are the ones who fly down south in the winter. They should be coming back. We're thinking that maybe these birds have come from south of here and are stopping in Salem for some reason on their way home."
"They don't usually do that?"
"I've been here all my life, Merrily, and I've never seen anything like it. They're all over the city."
"Interesting," I said. "Very interesting. In fact, do you think it might be a good topic for a beginning investigative reporter to look into?" Her eyes sparkled, and a smile lit up her face.
"It's perfect. I'll bet Bruce Doane will love it."
"I'm counting on that," I said.
"I've already started digging into it, so why don't you check with him?"
"I will," I said, "right away. And I'll see if he'll assign Therese to video the action. We'll get started first thing in the morning." Orion looked up from his bowl.
"Ah,"
he said.
"No?"
"Ah."
"Oh, you're right. I have to go gown shopping tomorrow morning with Shannon." Aunt Ibby laughed.
"You realize you're talking to a cat, don't you?"
I nodded.
"Yeah, you do it too."
It was true. There's no doubt about it. Orion is no ordinary house cat. I can't explain it, and wouldn't even try. It may have something to do with the witch, Ariel. Orion, so people say, was her familiar. We just know he's special.
"Well, you may as well begin gathering information," my aunt said, hanging her apron on a hook behind the pantry door. "It'll probably impress Mr. Doane if you have a grasp of some facts about the creatures before you propose the project. Want to see what I've learned so far?"
"I do. Let me run upstairs and change fast into something comfortable, and I'll be right back."
I wasn't kidding about changing fast. Orion followed me up to my apartment,
where I washed my face and hands, brushed some cat hair from the suit, and hung it carefully in my closet, and put on faded old cutoffs and a Police Athletic League t-shirt. Racing down the back stairs, I even beat the cat to the kitchen. Having an idea for my brand new investigative reporter gig was exciting, and getting some answers to the mysterious sudden influx of crows to Salem made the whole thing more intriguing. I joined on